ready to hear oral argument in the case of Webster against Carraway. Mr. Wells.
Thank you, Your Honor. Stephen Wells and Kirsten Schubert on behalf of Defendant Webster in this case. The question before this court today is whether Section 2241 of 28 U.S.C. provides a mechanism for the review of evidence which establishes categorical ineligibility for the death penalty for Mr. Webster, destroys the government's case at trial, but was not reasonably available to Mr. Webster because this is evidence that was in government files and not produced, or otherwise the defense was not otherwise made aware of it until after the first habeas. The government contends that it doesn't matter how conclusive the evidence, it doesn't matter how unavailable the evidence. 2241 does not provide such a mechanism. We contend that it does, because 2255 H1 and H2 do not provide a reasonable opportunity for defendant to test the reliability
of
his conviction.
Your client made the basic argument at trial to the jury, to the Fifth Circuit on appeal, and then to the Fifth Circuit on collateral review. In your view, how many times is your client entitled to repeat the same argument?
He's entitled, Your Honor, he is entitled to make the argument based on evidence which was not reasonably available to him at the time.
No, I'm asking how many times.
If he could,
it sounds in your view like the answer is infinite. Each time a client comes up with a new piece of evidence, he can start over. Obviously, Congress has said no. Why does one want to read 2241 to defeat that decision?
Well, Your Honor, I think he would have as many opportunities as he would have under 2255 H1 if the new evidence went to actual innocence. Congress did not put an absolute limit under H1, and it has not put a limit under 2241 as well. The question is, was this a reasonable opportunity? Not did he have any opportunity to raise the arguments without the available evidence, but did he have a reasonable opportunity?
Well,
he only had a reasonable
opportunity. If you put it that way, very hard to avoid the answer yes. He had a complete opportunity, he had two complete opportunities to litigate this claim to the gills, to put in every piece of evidence he wanted, to get a decision by a district judge, a district judge, a court of appeals, followed by a district judge and a court of appeals. And he did that.
This evidence was not reasonably available to him.
Why was it not reasonably available? He knew his own Social Security file.
Because the trial lawyer, the defense lawyer, asked for this and, to the best of his recollection, was told that there were no records. That is uncontroverted.
No. We think of evidence as being unavailable to a litigant when both the litigant and his lawyer don't know it.
Atkins is very, very clear, Your Honor. One of the reasons for the categorical ineligibility of the mental retarded is that they are not able to participate
in their defense. That was the very issue that was resolved adversely to your client twice. The question is whether he was unable or whether he was malingering. And the Fifth Circuit concluded that the jury reasonably concluded that your client is a malingerer.
Without ever considering the critical evidence that showed that he wasn't a malingerer. And that's the basis for our motion, Your Honor. This evidence is very conclusive in a number of different ways. It destroys the government's argument at trial. And if I may explain. The government had three prongs to its mental retardation case at trial. Prong number one was, show Bruce Webster was faking his IQ test. Prong number two was, bring in people from the school to say there was no special education and that Bruce wasn't in special education classes. Prong number three was, with respect to adaptive functioning, attack every expert as being biased and incredible. That was the government's case, and to present minimal evidence about
and
prison.
And the jury believed the government's experts.
Without having seen this critical evidence, Your Honor. And if they had seen this critical evidence, why does it destroy the government's case? Number one, it was three evaluations by government doctors, the same government that was calling the witnesses against him. It was done at a time before the commission of any crime. There was no possibility of bias. Why was it also important? because these were government doctors charged with weeding out fakers, and one in particular said there was no evidence of malingering. So no bias and no malingering. No bias on behalf of Bruce.
I think you're overstating the strength of this evidence, because only one of the examining doctors, as I understand it, actually performed an IQ test.
Well, one, it's not just the IQ test, Your Honor. The IQ test is obviously highly relevant because it shows it was done by in an unbiased setting where Bruce Webster didn't have the motivation to fake. But the evidence is also very strong with respect to adaptive function in three ways. And that was really the issue, one of the main issues at trial, and the jury never got to hear this evidence. The adaptive functioning evidence is both direct and it's inferential.
Well, none of these doctors were doing an evaluation for mental retardation in the sense of an Atkins review. They were evaluating his claim for Social Security benefits for a sinus condition, as I understood it.
Right, but he was actually sent out for separate evaluation for psychological.
Right, so these are sort of in the nature, with the exception of the doctor who did administer an IQ test, these were just in the nature, as I understand the record, of sort of clinical observations rather than actual evaluations for determining his adaptive functioning in the sense meant by Atkins or his IQ.
Well, one is there's two direct diagnoses by psychologists. One did an IQ test, the other one apparently didn't do an IQ test. But they all address the issue of adaptive functioning. The diagnosis by the one doctor, again, at a time when Bruce didn't have the motivation to fake and no bias on behalf of the doctors, uses the DSM evaluation code 317. That's at separate appendix 359. So it's clear that he had to consider, since that's adaptive functioning is one of the issues, he had to consider adaptive functioning at the time.
How is this evidence not cumulative to what was presented at trial? He had multiple IQ examinations that were admitted in the sentencing phase, as I understand it.
It's not cumulative for two main reasons. One is that the claim at trial was that Bruce was faking all these. He faked the IQ test and he faked the adaptive functioning tests. And he was faking, according to the government, to avoid the death penalty. That obviously is not true in the context of which these tests were provided. It's also important for this reason, Your Honor. The government's attack on the adaptive functioning evidence was that every one of the defense doctors was incredible and could not be believed because they were not objective. And in the words of the closing argument of the prosecution, we have Mr. PhD objective keys. They were all out to help Bruce, and the jury couldn't trust them. That's not true. That argument cannot be made with respect to these independent diagnoses by the United States government itself. So that's why it's not merely cumulative. It really goes to the heart of the government's case. There's a third reason why it's not merely cumulative, and that goes to the existence of the special education records. The prosecution brought out witness after witness. It was obviously an important part of their case to say that Bruce Webster was not in special education classes. And that was used to bootstrap their argument that he wasn't mentally retarded. But now it turns out that he was apparently in special education classes because the school district had to admit that the records had been destroyed. The government used that not only to show that Bruce was not mentally retarded, the government used the absence of special education to show that Bruce was lying. And I can quote the part of the transcript where this is from. The government, it's on separate appendix page 324 through 25. This is on direct examination. By the prosecution, doctor, based on your training, based on your experience, aside from it being just a lie, Webster's statement that he had been in special education classes, does it have some particular meaning to you in the context of an examination of this type for mental retardation? Answer, yes, it does. Question, what is that doctor? Answer, if a criminal defendant has a desire to be found mentally retarded, then telling someone, an evaluator, that he has been in special education classes would certainly be in keeping with the concept of possible mental retardation, and it would be an attempt to persuade that person that you had mental deficiencies that you didn't actually have. So the government used what they thought was Bruce Webster's false statement, which that he had been in special education classes, to sort of bootstrap the notion that he was a manipulator, that he was lying, and that he actually did have adaptive functioning deficits. That's wrong. So I'd say, Your Honor, those are the three main reasons why the evidence that we seek to present here would have made a difference at trial, would have led the jury to conclude that Bruce Webster was mentally retarded, and absolutely destroyed the government's arguments against it. The IQ test, I know the government tries to minimize the importance of the IQ test, and they essentially say, well, we've sort of conceded that he had low IQ scores. Well, they never conceded the validity of the IQ scores. And in fact, the government's testimony went on for pages and pages of trial transcript about how Bruce Webster had the motivation to fake, and that's why his IQ scores, though they might be low, couldn't be trusted and weren't valid. Dr. Parker, which was one of the prosecution's experts, mentions this four times. It's at separate appendix 303, 304, 305, 308. Dr. Coons, another expert, goes on for pages on this topic. It's in the separate appendix 316, 317, 318, 319, 324, 325, 327. This was the subject of cross of Dr. Fulbright. It's at the trial transcript in volume 24 at pages 156 through 161. It went on forever. So it is not true that the government conceded the validity of his low IQ scores. They contested it hotly, and it was a key part of their trial. And if the jury had known that Bruce Webster had been evaluated by government doctors, one of whom actually performed the Wechsler test on him, and that he had scored in the range of mental retardation, without any motivation to do so, since he was being evaluated for a sinus condition.
I'm puzzled by this argument, which you make several times, that he didn't have any motivation to malinger. He was applying to the government for a lifetime stream of money.
For a sinus condition.
Why didn't he have a motive to do what was necessary to get it?
And Your Honor, why is it logical to suppose that somebody who's being evaluated for a sinus condition would fake mental retardation? I don't think so. I don't think there's a logical connection there.
You don't think people try to deceive the Social Security Administration in benefits cases?
By faking
somebody here is being very credulous.
By faking conditions that they aren't under evaluation for? I think that's a stretch, Your Honor. Let me turn to the law briefly with the time that I have left here. I think the facts are very important here, but I do want to address the legal basis for this, because I think it's credible too, important too. Under 2255 H1, Congress has carved out two exceptions that are simply not applicable here. And Section 2255 E is the safety valve that Congress said should be employed when the remedies provided in 2255 are inadequate or ineffective. I think it's fair to say that the jurisprudence of this court has been evolving based on the facts that have been presented to it. In Davenport, this court suggested that the safety valve, Section E, would only apply to retroactive statutory decisions that essentially negated the existence of the crime for which the defendant was convicted. But in Garza, the court broadened that a little bit and said, well, it's not just retroactive statutory decisions. It's also it can also arise in the context of a treaty and treaty obligations. And then in Brown, the court broadened it even further to indicate
there
that...
There hasn't, so far as I can see, counsel, there hasn't been any change whatsoever in the law.
We're not arguing a statutory change in the law, Your Honor.
There hasn't been any change in the law.
We're not arguing that there's been any change in the law. We are arguing that this is as important as a change in the law. This is the standard that this court really has laid down throughout, and which this court has been consistent about, is whether the essential function of habeas is impaired by Section 2255. And as this court said in Davenport, the essential function is to give a prisoner a reasonable opportunity to obtain a reliable judicial determination of a fundamental legality of his conviction and sentence. Without having evidence of this importance, which was not reasonably available to the defendant at the time, it can't be said that there was a reasonable opportunity. The standard is not any opportunity. The standard is a reasonable opportunity. and where evidence isn't reasonably available, that 2255E does not provide a mechanism. Constitutionally, of course, there's no difference between the importance of the right not to be executed if you're categorically ineligible for the death penalty versus the right not to be executed if you're factually innocent of the crime. Congress carved out an exception for one. It didn't address the other. And there's no indication in the legislative history or otherwise that when Congress passed 2255, it was thinking about newly discovered evidence that would go to categorical ineligibility. There's nothing in the legislative history about that, and there's certainly nothing in the statute about that. And so, as in debt, we're not arguing that this is a retroactive statutory decision. We're suggesting that that basis that the court has found in other cases where it has been presented to this court is not the only basis for the exception under 2255.
Well, of course, the Fifth Circuit held against your client on that argument.
No, only that it was not that under 2255H1 that what we were arguing wasn't covered by 2255H1, and therefore we weren't subject to the 2255H1 exception. That's what the Fifth Circuit held. It held that because it said H1 only applies to innocence of the underlying crime. And since that wasn't what we were arguing, we weren't allowed to use that exception. And our point is, that's why we're allowed to use 2255E. This is as important as actual innocence, in the sense of underlying crime. There's no constitutional basis for saying it's more important to not execute the categorically ineligible than it is the actual innocent. And yet there is no mechanism under 2255, no mechanism for consideration of newly discovered evidence. The Supreme Court recently reiterated how important it is for a defendant claiming categorical ineligibility to have a fair opportunity to present all of the evidence related to categorical ineligibility. And it did that in the Hall case. And we suggest that here, that on the extraordinary facts of this case, this is a situation in which the court should equate this with newly discovered evidence of actual innocence and provide an exception that Congress didn't, because 2255, H1 and H2 simply don't cover this. Let me address one issue that Your Honor touched on, Judge Easterbrook, and that the government has raised too, which is, where's the end of this, and does this just go on and on forever? These facts are extraordinary in this case. I mean, this is information that was sitting in government files and that apparently trial counsel was told didn't exist.
Well, that apparently is kind of a big issue underneath this case, because all we have is trial counsel's declaration that he made a request for these documents because he knew about these evaluations, and he doesn't remember whether or not he got any response. And so he's surmising that he must have been told. Well, that's as good as it gets.
His best recollection, I think, is that the records weren't produced.
Even a best recollection. It's a good faith belief is what he says.
This was,
which isn't saying, you know, that's my best recollection. It's, I don't recall. And he actually said, I don't recall whether I got anything or not. I don't recall seeing these documents before. I don't recall what response I got. So I am basically assuming in good faith that I was told they didn't exist. That's a big assumption.
Well, we are dealing with facts that were over a decade old when we contacted the trial counsel to find out about this. There are no records in the file. No one has ever suggested that these records were produced to trial counsel or anybody else until we got them. And the circumstances of their production to us were so odd and so suspicious, frankly, that I don't think there's any reason to suspect that anything he says is inaccurate. Certainly the government has never contested anything that he said. And the circumstances under which we came by the records, Your Honor, was we made a request. We got a partial disclosure from the Social Security Administration, and then, as the affidavit of my colleague indicates, We were essentially told that they were provided to us by mistake. And then when we followed up with more requests, we were told, and this was at a time when the Social Security Administration knew, because we had told them, that these records were for use in a capital case, in a death penalty case. We were told by the Social Security Administration that the entire file had been destroyed. So we're in, there's been no discovery. We haven't had privy to this. The government presumably has. The silence about exactly what the circumstances were and why this happened and any kind of rebutting evidence from the government is non-existent. They haven't put in any affidavits about this. There's been no one from the Social Security Administration who's explained this. No one from the Social Security Administration has ever said they did produce these records or explained why they destroyed the file, I mean, to trial counsel or to us, or explained why the file was destroyed. So I don't think there's any objective, there's certainly no contrary evidence from the government, and I don't think there's any objective evidence to indicate that the Social Security Administration offered or did make these records available to trial counsel at the time. And I do want to make one thing clear is there's no indication from trial counsel that he knew what was in these records. All he knew was that Bruce had been evaluated for a sinus condition. That's what he knew the family had told him. So there's no indication that trial counsel had any idea what was in these records, that he'd been evaluated for MR or what the diagnoses were, what the records contained.
Your interpretation of the statutory scheme, the 2241-2255 interaction, really would permit endless habeas petitions challenging sentencing proceedings based on newly discovered evidence.
No.
And I mean, I just don't see a limiting principle in your argument.
Well, no more, no less than under 2255 H1 that deals with new evidence of actual innocence. Your Honor, I think the limiting principle is the pre-AEDPA standards of cause and prejudice, which existed prior to AEDPA and which would presumably apply.
But the whole point of the 1996 amendment was to change that. Your view seems to be that the 1996 amendment is self-defeating. By limiting the number of collateral attacks one can make, Congress made 2255 ineffective, and therefore collateral attacks can continue without limit of number.
No, I'm not suggesting that it's self-defeating at all. I'm suggesting that just as Congress may have overlooked the existence of retroactive statutory decisions.
You are. You said earlier that the number of collateral challenges one can make is unlimited. Every time somebody comes up with new evidence, a new collateral challenge can be made, quite without regard to what Congress wrote in the statute in 1996.
Well, what I'm saying is...
That was your own argument.
Well, no, what I'm saying, Your Honor, to be clear, is it's no more and no less limited than what's under 2255 H1. You could make the same argument with respect to new evidence with respect to 2255 H1. That's the same argument.
Does your argument apply to non-capital cases?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Your argument extends to non-capital cases, sentencing, new evidence on sentencings?
No, our argument, Your Honor, I'm confining our argument to the extraordinary facts here, which deal
with... Well, I know, but that's not a limiting principle legally.
I think when it goes to categorical ineligibility, in other words, what this court has said is it has to go to a fundamental issue of the legality of the sentence. It has to be a fundamental right that's at issue here. And what we're talking about here is categorical ineligibility. Death is different. The Supreme Court has been very clear about that, of course. And so I think it is fair to limit it to new evidence that goes to categorical ineligibility, and that was not reasonably available at the time to the defense. But you know, with respect to whether or not could anybody make claims individually, well, not under cause and prejudice standards that existed prior to AEDPA, and even under the limitations of H1 and H2, the court doesn't say, well, if you make a new evidence claim based on actual innocence under H1, you only get one. It didn't say that. It didn't put an absolute number on it. So I think cause and prejudice are essentially, the standards of cause and prejudice are essentially a part of 2255 H1 and 2255 H2. And we're not saying the floodgates are open and anybody can make
any. Well, what's the universe of categorical ineligibility claims?
Two, basically. Juvenile status and mental retardation. And so we're talking about a very, very limited number of potential claimants, if you will, under 2255E and 2241. And we're only talking about federal prisoners as well. You know, the one other fact I'd like to point out is that this court, I guess, is being placed in the somewhat unusual position of being the fact finder of first review. No court has made a fact finding to date, whether it's Fifth Circuit or here, about whether the evidence was reasonably available or whether it did establish mental retardation. What we would request is the court find that there is a mechanism under 2241 for a court to determine that, and that the district court engage in fact-finding and allow the parties discovery in order to determine whether or not this evidence was both available and whether it would have made a difference. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Wes Hendricks on behalf of the United States. The government is not asking this court to be a fact finder in the first instance. To the contrary, we're asking this court to enforce statutory limitations created by Congress in passing AEDPA. And what Webster asked this court to do today is something that no court has ever done, and that is to allow 2241 to be a vehicle for presenting new evidence in order to challenge the validity of a sentence. But again, the statutory framework reflects Congress's choice to disallow that possibility. Because Webster here was able to litigate the issue of his mental retardation both at trial, on direct appeal from that trial, and in 2255, and in an appeal from that 2255, nothing about the structure of 2255 is broken for him. He was permitted to raise that claim, and because of that, it's not inadequate or ineffective. This court, of course, defined what is inadequate or ineffective initially in Davenport. And there were three requirements. First, that there be a statutory interpretation case. Well, we have a concession today that that's not what they rely on. The second requirement is that there be something made retroactive, some new law, some new claim, something showing something new that was unable to be presented during the time of trial and the initial collateral attack. Well, again, we have a concession that there is nothing new here. At the time of the trial in the 2255, there was both statute and then eventually a Supreme Court case that made clear we don't execute the mentally retarded, and that's against the law. He was able to litigate that issue, and the district court decided he didn't meet his burden, and he was not mentally retarded, and he was therefore eligible for the death penalty. The final requirement really hasn't been discussed much today, and that there be a grave miscarriage of justice that must be corrected. And we simply don't have one here. Congress is the one that chose this limitation. In Hope, this court explained, in response to an attempt to present new evidence to challenge the validity of a sentence, albeit in the 2254 arena, that that wouldn't be permissible because Congress made a choice and abrogated Sawyer, which allowed challenges to the validity of the death penalty, by limiting successive petitions in 2255 based on new evidence to those that involve new evidence showing innocence of the offense, not innocence of the sentence. That was a choice that was made by Congress. That's one consideration. When you couple that consideration with this court's observation in Taylor, among other cases, that the mere fact that 2255 limits successive petitions to, for instance, those showing new evidence of actual innocence of the crime, doesn't make 2255 inadequate or ineffective. It just shows that Congress made choice to limit the number and types of collateral attacks. Nothing about that choice results in a miscarriage of justice. As explained in Garza, otherwise, the careful structure Congress has created to avoid repetitive filings would mean little or nothing. Additionally, again, there's no glitch here. It's not as though this is a Bailey claim that couldn't be presented earlier and we have a person sitting in jail for a crime that wasn't committed and we have a new Supreme Court case that's been made retroactive that now makes that clear. He was able to present this and he did. The Savings Clause is about procedural fairness. It's not about substantive results. And there's no doubt here that there's been plenty of process. This conviction is almost 20 years old. There's also no miscarriage of justice because the reason Congress chose these limitations is for finality. As explained in Davenport, Society is unwilling to expend an indefinitely large amount of judicial resources on repeat testing of convictions and sentences. It's a choice made by Congress, and all we do is ask this court to enforce those limitations today. Additionally, there's no miscarriage of justice because we do have to consider the ramifications of, if this is allowed, what is the limiting principle? And we have some very honest concessions that really the only limitation would be those placed on 2255H1. Well, in effect, there are no limitations on H1. If you have new evidence showing that you are innocent of your crime, you can bring that claim in 2255H1. Congress chose that as a permissible basis for a successive petition. It didn't choose, however, a successive petition to show innocence of your sentence. And then finally, there's no miscarriage of justice because although his judicial remedies are hopefully coming to an end, he has other remedies available. If the evidence really is as he views it, which the government, of course, disagrees, that it's so probative and overwhelming to show his mental retardation, he can petition the president for clemency. As explained in Herrera by the Supreme Court, that is the traditional route for relief when the time for judicial remedies has run. And finally, he could bring a Ford claim, which is kind of the other side of the coin.
He can do what?
He could bring a Ford claim, and what I mean by that, I'm referencing the Supreme Court's decision in Ford that discussed a person sitting on death row, if they believe they are incompetent to be executed and they don't understand.
You mean they have no knowledge of what it's, or appreciation of what they're being punished for.
Correct.
That's the only issue.
That's right. And if these documents and evidence show that he doesn't have that appreciation, he can ask a district court to stop the execution.
I'm lost. Isn't that the very thing he asked for in this case, which you say he's not entitled to have a district judge consider?
Competency is different than mental retardation. The question of mental retardation...
I am now... You're losing me. The federal statute that governs this, 18 U.S.C. 3596C, has two sentences. One says sentence of death can't be carried out on a person who's mentally retarded, and the second sentence says a sentence of death cannot be carried out on a person who, as a result of mental disability, lacks the mental capacity to understand the death penalty or why it was imposed on that person. Right? That's 1994. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in Ford that isn't in that statute. So are you suggesting that a 2241 claim can't be brought under the first sentence of this statute, but can be brought under the second sentence?
I don't believe it would be. No, I'm not suggesting that.
It wouldn't make any sense, would it?
It wouldn't. And no. I'm not suggesting that. I don't understand a Ford claim to be brought in the 2241 arena.
Ford was itself brought under 2254, if I recall correctly. It was a state prisoner. And a state prisoner doesn't have the benefit of this federal statute. But both sentences of this federal statute have already been litigated. Now, I would understand an argument in your position that if the defendant said, if the person on death row says, my mental state has changed recently, that might be brought, as the Supreme Court has said, as a Bivens claim or under 1983, Bivens, since this is federal. But I don't understand Webster to be contending that his mental condition has changed since it was evaluated.
Nor do I, Your Honor, and I take the point, and I don't mean to suggest that the government believes he would have a high chance of success on that claim.
If the prisoner suggested that he accepts the fact that he was adjudicated as competent sufficiently, sir, but something has happened since then, not something before, something since that made him unable to deny. Comprehend why they're doing it. That's when you're, I think that's what triggers the right to file any additional beef.
I understand.
Is that the position of government?
Yes, that is how we understand it as well. Yeah. And if he believes something has changed, he could try to make that claim. We would resist it, of course.
But he has to first concede the first that he was the finding, or at least give up fighting about the finding and say that something happened afterwards, assuming that I was totally competent. At the time I was sentenced, I have subsequently lost my marbles, so to speak, and can no longer meet that standard. And that's the government.
I understand, Your Honor, and I did not
mean to. I've spent hours in the prison library reading judicial decisions, and they've driven me insane. That would actually be plausible.
And I do not mean to take us off on a route, because, of course, the question here is not his competency. He did not contest that at trial, and that's not an issue here. It was an attempt, and a confusing one, and I apologize for that, to show that there is no miscarriage of justice here, because he was able to litigate it, because this is a congressional choice, and although his judicial remedies are done, there are other routes available to him. There was a lot of discussion that somehow the government didn't produce these documents, and some nefarious insinuations. The government strongly opposes that. There's no evidence at all to indicate that. To the contrary, the evidence indicates these documents were previously available to him. His family told trial counsel, defense counsel, that they took him to the Social Security Administration for testing. And that's what resulted in the trial counsel's letter that was faxed to the Social Security Administration, that's attached to the LaRue declaration in the record, saying, "Very nice talking to you today. I appreciate the help. We're going to send an investigator to Arkansas to pick up the documents. He's going to have a business records affidavit, so you don't have to come testify. See you soon." At that point, we don't know what happened after that. We don't know why those documents were never received from the Social Security office. There's a discussion in defense counsel's declaration that says, "I have this good faith belief that I never received them." But again, we have the LaRue declaration that says, "I've examined the file." And there was no response whatsoever from the Social Security Administration. So I'm not sure what the good faith belief that he was told there were no documents is when the file, based on Dorsey's own paralegal, gives no indication of a response whatsoever. Additionally, the documents, and really the subject matter of this, was available, and this is something that the government didn't notice in its initial reviewing of the record. But Mr. Webster's mother testified during the sentencing phase of trial, and a question arose when he got out of jail for burglary: did you ever take him to get any services from the state? And what they were driving at was that he got food stamps, that he couldn't take care of himself, so he doesn't have adaptive skills. But her answer didn't go there. Her answer said, "Oh, yes, I took him to the Social Security Administration." That's in the record at volume 23, page 152. Now, there was no follow-up to that. There wasn't, "Oh, tell me about that. What happened there? Who'd he see? Do you know?" It was right there at trial, and no questions were asked. Now, I don't know why. Perhaps it's because we know now from the records, and perhaps the family told defense counsel, that disability was ultimately denied. And maybe that noise of, "Yeah, he was tested, but there was a denial," led the trial counsel to make a strategic choice. But it's not in the record. We don't know. But we do know that the mother at trial testified she took her son to the Social Security Administration. Perhaps the best evidence that these documents were available is Dorsey's own experience. After an initial request to the Social Security office, over 10 years later, they got an initial response that said, "Well, you didn't do it quite right. We need this special form." And they said, "Okay." So they sent another one. And then less than 2 months later, they received the documents. They followed up after an initial response of, "You didn't do this right." They followed up. And less than 2 months later, they got the documents that they sought. Now, again, there's a suggestion that somehow something nefarious is happening in the Social Security Administration. There's no evidence of that, and the government disagrees with that. The LaRue Declaration demonstrates that after receiving the documents, they asked for more. They asked for any and all documents relating to Webster, including this list. The response then was, "Well, we know we've given you some documents already, but protocol wasn't followed. You're actually required to go to the Social Security Administration in the state where you reside. That's not Arkansas. That's Indiana here. And so please go do that." Is that bureaucratic? Yes, of course it is. Is that perhaps a cold response in a situation like this? Perhaps. But it's not nefarious. There's no indication of that whatsoever. There's also no evidence of the trial counsel during the 2255 proceeding, which is really what we're here about today. I mean, we're here asking whether the 2255 proceeding Mr. Webster had was inadequate or ineffective to test the legality of his detention. And we know that there's no indication whatsoever that defense counsel during the 2255 made any effort whatsoever to obtain these documents, which he knew was attempted by the trial counsel during trial. There's also a lot of discussion that somehow these documents really just completely destroy the government's case. They are not cumulative, that they are a game changer. And there are three reasons given. They show that Webster was not faking. They support the expert testimony, which we challenged at trial. And then finally, they show evidence regarding special education. Regarding Mr. Webster's faking and the expert's motivation, one thing that wasn't mentioned during my colleague's opening argument was that they were able and did present substantially similar evidence to the evidence in these documents. In fact, it was even better, because there was no possibility of a motivation to get a lifetime of benefits. There was a 1992 essential diagnosis of mental retardation. After Mr. Webster's brothers died, his mother took him to a medical clinic in Arkansas, and he was tested. Those documents were admitted to trial. What are those? Those are pre-crime documents of mental evaluations by doctors essentially saying he is mentally retarded. So that is evidence that, look, he's not doing this to try to avoid the death penalty. He's not faking. You can believe our experts. Everything they want to get from these documents, they tried to get from those documents. Now, we know the district court ultimately didn't buy it, but those documents were there. Dr. Finn, one of the defense experts, testified, quote, there is a sentence in these documents that says, Mr. Webster is presently functioning within the mild to moderate range of intellectual and cognitive abilities. And then he goes on to explain, quote, what they mean by that is that he is mildly retarded. That's in the record at volume 23, page 213. Dr. Keyes essentially testified to the same thing, agreeing that the documents established that he was in the mild to moderate range of mental retardation. So they presented pre-crime evidence of what they viewed as mental retardation. The court and jury considered it, and the court and jury rejected it. They say, well, okay, stay with us. There's a lot of evidence of adaptive skills. It's not just the IQ test. There's evidence of the adaptive skills in these documents. And that's also what makes them critical. Well, to that, the government responds that every observation and conclusion that are included in these documents was presented at trial. They rely on the documents, these allegedly new documents, to show his poor syntax and grammar and handwriting. Well, at trial, his girlfriend testified that she got letters from him. Other letters written by the defendant were admitted. Dr. Keyes testified about his poor grammar and syntax. Even the government at closing argument said, okay, fine, he has terrible handwriting. That doesn't make him mentally retarded. They also rely on the documents to establish, hey, he really is a slow learner, where his brother Mark testified to that, his sister Future testified to that, and Dr. Finn testified to that. They rely on them because they show that he didn't finish ninth grade. That wasn't disputed at trial. His family testified to that fact. They like that it shows poor memory and comprehension in their view. Again, a topic that was greatly discussed and presented through Dr. Keyes at trial in volume 24. His poor communication, his alleged poor communication. Again, his brother and Dr. Finn testified to that in volume 23. He lives with his mother. He's given money. Other people take care of him. All of that. His brother and mother testified to that in volume 23. The fact that he doesn't have a job. Again, mother and brother testified to that. More importantly, so the upshot here, the fact that he can't manage funds. His mom testified to that. And that he's not malingering, finally. The experts testified that they tested for that and there was no sign of it. Even the government's expert had to admit that he gave a test to test for certain malingering related to the intellectual testing, and the malingering test indicated that he wasn't malingering related to his intellectual abilities. So these are purely cumulative and wholly cumulative. They are not game changers in the way that's been suggested today. As for the school letter, that is also, even putting aside the fact that does it or does it not establish that, without a doubt, that he was in special education, despite the fact that a principal, a vice principal, a counselor, and two teachers testified that he was not, putting aside that, his brother testified that he was in special education classes. This was something that was presented to the judge and jury and was considered by the judge and jury. And as the district court here and the Fifth Circuit explained, the issue of special education or no special education wasn't the driver. And by the way, his former argument about special education in 2255 was, my counsel was ineffective because I didn't get special education classes. Did you get that? I didn't get special education classes. But the reason was because of a racial motivation, and my lawyer was ineffective. Now the argument again has changed, but it doesn't matter because it's cumulative of what was presented. There's also a suggestion in the reply brief that the government only focuses on evidence of adaptive skills that were in prison. And adaptive skills evidence, while imprisoned, is not the gold standard, really. That's a great overstatement, a really understatement of the government's evidence at trial. And a close reading of the record establishes just the opposite. There was an overwhelming amount of evidence presented of adaptive skills outside of the prison environment. His girlfriend testified that he was a drug dealer, and that's how he got his money. She saw him count his money, and when this crime occurred and the police were getting close, he asked her to lie, that if the police come looking for me, tell them that we were together. Five school employees testified about his conduct outside of prison, and perhaps most importantly was his own behavior, his own criminal behavior, before he was sent to jail for this crime. During trial, the court asks the defense expert, let me ask, is leadership something that is consistent or inconsistent with mental retardation? And the defense expert said, oh no, that would be extremely inconsistent. But the evidence showed that Webster was a leader both before, during, and after this kidnapping. Before, he was brought in to lead this charge. His co-defendants were in Dallas, he wasn't there, and they said, we need to bring somebody that knows how to do this. We got to bring in Bruce. That's in volume 24-102, 1889, and 1942. Upon arrival, he said, hey, I'm going to need some gloves, and I'm going
to
need
I don't think it's necessary to go over this. We've read the decisions, and we don't have before us any question on the merits. We only have a legal question.
I agree, Your Honor, and I would ask this court, I think this court can begin and end its analysis by simply enforcing the plain language of 2255 and 2241. I feel obligated to respond to the reply brief that somehow this is not cumulative and that the government's evidence of adaptive skills was weak. But you are absolutely right, Your Honor. This court can end and begin with the fact that no court has ever allowed 2241 to be a vehicle to present new evidence to challenge a sentence. At the end of the day, Mr. Webster is asking this court for a do-over. He would like to present more of the same type of evidence that he presented at trial. But that evidence is not probative. It's not nearly as probative as he says it is. And he had the opportunity to do that at trial. He had the opportunity to present it in his 2255. And he doesn't like the result. And that alone, plus his frustration with Congress's choice in limiting successive petitions in 2255, is insufficient for this court to reverse the district court here. And unless the court has further questions, the government would gladly yield the remainder of its time. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Anything further, Mr. Wells?
Thank you, Your Honor. A few points. Number one, the government's contention is that that Congress made a clear choice to exclude from 2255 newly discovered evidence that was not reasonably available at the time that would establish mental retardation or other categorical ineligibility. There is no indication that Congress so intended. There's nothing in the legislative history. And if the argument is, well, Congress looked at newly discovered evidence and decided to limit it to only to evidence of actual innocence, that same argument could have been made with respect to 2255H2. This court could have said, well, Congress considered which retroactive decisions would provide the basis for a successive petition. And it decided that only constitutional decisions would provide a basis. And yet this court said, because a fundamental right was involved, that Congress may have overlooked it. Congress may have overlooked the fact that statutory decisions, retroactive statutory decisions, are of such a fundamental nature that they should provide a successive or an initial petition. And that's what we are saying with respect to this case. This is a fundamental prohibition that the Supreme Court has reinforced time and time again. You may not execute the mentally retarded. There is no indication that Congress considered new evidence of categorical ineligibility when it enacted AEDPA, zero. And there is no process, zero process, under 2255 for someone to raise newly discovered evidence that goes to categorical ineligibility, no matter how conclusive, no matter how unavailable to the defense counsel. That cannot be what Congress intended. There is no indication that Congress intended that. And I agree, it is a question of law for this court. And I think if there's fact-finding to be done, and if the court wants to determine whether or not this is cumulative and how available the evidence was, that should be a question for the district court. The district court here, though, never considered any of that information because its hands were tied, it felt. It felt that the statute that the escape clause, as Judge Posner calls it, 2255B, simply didn't apply here. And so no matter how conclusive the evidence, no matter how unavailable it was, it simply couldn't be evaluated. This is about process, and there is no process under 2255 for any court to evaluate 2255H1 and H2, for any court to evaluate this. That is what 2255E is all about. When there is a fundamental right and there is no process to consider evidence going to that fundamental right, then 2241 kicks in. That is our argument. With respect to the evidence, I'll just touch on it briefly. I want to make this point with respect to all the arguments that deal with cumulativeness, and that is, it's not cumulative if they go to the basis for the very attacks that the prosecution made on the evidence at trial. And as I pointed out in my first arguments, every piece of evidence that I've outlined goes directly to the attacks that the prosecution was making on the defense evidence at trial and obliterates it. The court has nothing further. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Court will be in recess.